We always have so many things to tell our audience about here at Intelligence Squared. So when I'm needing a top-down view of it all, I don't want to feel like I'm looking at organized chaos. That's why I really love Notion, which lays out different threads of work in a beautifully designed layout. And despite all of its clever AI tech going on in the background, it feels as clear and easy as putting pen to paper. Remember that? But with Notion, you can do a lot more than jot down a few thoughts. Notion is a place where any team can write, plan, organize, and rediscover the joy of play. And thanks to its AI-powered model, the way it works is so intuitive, every question has an answer. I still love my paper notebook, but sitting next to Notion, it might need to up its game a little bit. Try Notion for free and up your game too when you go to notion.com/squared. That's all lowercase letters, notion.com/squared, lowercase. So you can start turning ideas into action. And when you use the link, you're supporting Intelligence Squared too. That's notion.com/squared.
What are you doing right now? Perhaps you're in the supermarket. Maybe you're on a run or on the commute. But wherever you are in the world, and whatever you're doing, right now you're also listening to my voice. This is the power of podcasts. The ability to communicate with your audience in an intimate and intentional way through audio. I'm Bea Duncan, Senior Partnerships Producer at Intelligence Squared. We've been a world-leading forum for talks, debates, and events for over two decades. And we also use our cutting-edge curation, creativity, and editorial expertise to elevate your brand to new audiences with podcasting. Intrigued? To find out what we can do for your organization, book into a free consultation with me today. Find out more by going to www.intelligencesquared.com/partnerships.
Welcome to Intelligence Squared. I'm producer Catherine Hughes. In an age where the line between cultural appreciation and cultural appropriation seems ever more blurred, it's worth asking if anyone can actually own a culture. In this episode of the podcast, acclaimed author and public intellectual Martin Puckner shows us that the history of mankind has always been a story of borrowing from one another, and that this is something to be celebrated and not lamented. Our host for this conversation is Edward Wilson Lee, fellow and lecturer at Sydney Sussex College, University of Cambridge. Here's Edward with more.
Martin is the Byron and Anita Wien Professor of English and Comparative Literature at Harvard University and the author of a large number of books on literature, cultural history and philosophy, amongst which I will just mention a few, such as 2017's The Written World, The Power of Stories to Shape People, History and Civilizations, and 2020's The Language of Thieves, about a secret code language targeted by the Nazis for elimination. But we're here tonight to discuss his most recent volume, which is Culture, A New World History, which is now out from Norton in the US and from Ithaca here in the UK. Martin, thank you so much for joining us. And I'm going to start by just getting a sense of how you embarked on this absolutely immense undertaking. And it is a book of enormous scope, chronologically, geographically, and thematically. So it moves from ancient Egypt in the beginning to K-pop in the end, from Mughal India to medieval Germany, taking in poetry and sculpture and anthropology and prayer and ritual and all sorts of things along the way. So what prompted you to undertake this, and how did you go about starting to think about such an utterly vast topic?
It started a couple of years ago in a context where people, especially who are in the humanities in academia, spend a lot of time wringing our hands about declining enrollments, and think people generally in arts and culture, people don't care about arts anymore, what's wrong, what's going on. And I spent a good deal of time bemoaning all of these things as well. But then at some point, I kind of paused and realized that I had actually never really asked myself some of these fundamental questions about culture, such as, why do we engage in this sort of non-utilitarian activity? How does culture actually work? How did it proceed? What are the big arcs? What are the big themes? of this human endeavor. And so then the pandemic hit and I, you know, was stuck at home and I thought, well, I have nothing better to do. Why don't I do it now? So I sort of dug in and tried to go as broad and wide, Edward, as you said, I ended up doing in order to sort of distill some of these important moments, turning points, sort of moments that sort of illustrate to me how culture really works. And I wanted to do that, you know, not in a big survey, but to sort of select these compelling case studies, about 15, and then tell them in a kind of narrative and sort of interesting, immersive way, hoping that out of, you know, the sequence of them, out of these different case studies, that bigger picture that I wanted to sketch would somehow emerge.
As you say, it's, you know, part of, you know, the one of the solutions or one of the potential solutions to declining admissions or enrollment is bringing the joy back. And I think this is one of the things that the book does very well, is just is bring the joy back. And also in an age of hyper-specialization where, you know, the tendency is to focus on quite small things, to think about these really big questions about what is culture and why should we preserve it. You said something in there which I want to come back to and press you a little further on. So one of the ways in which the book's is structured is by focusing on moments of transmission and, you know, what I think you call special places and institutions of meaning making. So places where culture is stored and reproduced and so on and so forth. Can you tell us a little bit about why we might choose to look at culture in that way, as opposed to looking, you know, at moments of creation or something like that?
At first, I didn't quite know what to emphasize. And so I really looked all over the place trying to think about different case studies. What emerged as a sort of through line and transmission, as you say, was one. And in a way, going back to the basics, the very perhaps banal fact that culture is not transmitted automatically, you know, unlike our genes that transmit our human genome to the next generation, when it comes to culture, cultural knowledge, we have to devise external storage media and ways of making sure that cultural knowledge gets transmitted to the next generation. And because otherwise it's lost, and it so much is lost all the time. So for me, storage and transmission became crucial. And so, you know, one place where I started is with cave art and the Chauvet cave in particular. And in part because these cave paintings are so amazing and, you know, 30, 40,000 years old, produced over a long period of time. But above all, I started to think of these caves as sort of one of the first storage places where culture and cultural knowledge was stored and transmitted to the next generation. And then, of course, there are others, libraries and universities and the internet and other technologies that fulfill that function. But caves and temples and theaters and other such institutions and places and storage technologies became central.
And I think, you know, part of the experience of a lot of beauty and artistic beauty is no different than any other, is a sense of ephemerality, the sense that this extraordinary thing that you're holding on to might simply disappear. I wonder whether also looking at moments of transmission does something to solve part of the problem of what we do with historical works of art, right? In that you and I both, as literature professors, you know that we are often caught in an enigma between trying to discern authorial purpose. What did the creator of this work mean? Which is often something that you can never quite get to and never be quite certain about, on the one hand. And on the other hand, throwing it wildly open to kind of reader reception. What did people take this to mean? Which, you know, to a certain extent, almost suggests that the work has no, that there's no responsibility to the work of art. So I wonder whether, you know, choosing moments of transition was a kind of halfway house in some way.
Yeah, you know, Edward, it's a very interesting way of putting it. I think you're right. You know, I do have some moments of creation, you know, for example, the Egyptian sculptor Thutmose, who creates this extraordinary sculpture of Queen Nefertiti. And so I, you know, I dwell on that, and that is sort of one of the early chapters. But then even more fascinating to me is the fact that that whole episode in Egyptian history, which was so radical because Queen Nefertiti invented a new god, you know, left Thebes, started a new city, invented a new aesthetics of representation, how that episode was deliberately erased from history by subsequent dynasties, perhaps because it was too startling and too revolutionary, and how it was then rediscovered and reinterpreted. And so these moments of broken transmission, where something is lost, where something gets interrupted and then is rediscovered after a break, that those became, to my mind, not exceptions, but really the rule. And it's very rare to find a genuinely continuous cultural tradition. There are always these interruptions and break. And so that became a special dynamic that really stood out for me. And so I think I tried to find as many episodes that look at that dynamic from different perspectives. Another one is a pillar by the Indian king Ashoka, a pillar he had inscribed in order to present a kind of Buddhist idea of Buddhist kingship that was very important to him, had become very important to him. And he erected these massive stone pillars in order to propagate this new belief and also to speak both to the future, and he hoped to export Buddhism abroad. After a while, the pillar became illegible, but then that didn't stop people from going to it, interpreting it, trying to understand why is this massive pillar there. Subsequent rulers find it, transport it to Delhi, then finally it's rediscovered and reinterpreted. Those are stories that I emphasized, I think, in precisely because of what you mentioned, Edward, namely that it's, of course, fascinating to think about these moments of creation. But the reason why we humans create cultural products which are not there for our survival is because of this kind of collective intergenerational process of meaning making. That's never complete, that's never at an end, that's ongoing, but apparently really crucial to us because we do it wherever we live. And so it seemed to me it was to get at that dynamic, these stories of transmission and rediscovery were more important, or at least as important, as just celebrating the originality of artists.
Yeah, wonderful. And one of the things that I found most fascinating in the book is the part that you talk about, the part that you see error and misunderstanding playing in the transmission of culture. So whether or not there are breaks in transmission, even if you're successful in keeping something in a kind of locked box, the context in which it was originally understood disappear, or they degrade, and suddenly it doesn't mean the same to the person who opens the box. So that old kind of new critical fantasy of the well-wrought urn in which you can put poetry and you seal it up and it comes out fresh as a daisy 400 years later is of course a fantasy, because it doesn't mean the same to everyone. So just to quote from the book, you write that errors are the way in which a culture experiments, allowing new generations to project their own concerns onto the past and to inject urgency into its continuation. I wonder if you could start by giving us a few examples of this kind of creative misinterpretation that you're thinking of. You've already given us one with Ashoka and Panis Pillar, but if you can say a little bit more about that, and then we can talk perhaps a little about what we can do with that idea.
Yeah. So as you say, errors became crucial, and it's odd because, as a teacher and researcher, I try to get things right. And in the book, I try to put things in their original context to help myself and readers understand where these things come from. But at the same time, this theme of error really stood out. And it seems to me in the end, efforts to minimize errors and misunderstandings are probably misguided, because they can be so generative and have been. So I just mentioned Ashoka, where people, once the inscription became illegible, nevertheless continued oral stories about who might have erected this pillar and what it might mean. And travelers come and encounter it, and there are legends, oral legends of various kinds. And we now know that they are not technically true, but these pillars are almost like magnets that attract cultural production, so to speak, stories, interpretations. And that perhaps is more important than getting it right. Another example is this, you mentioned locked boxes. I actually became obsessed with sort of time capsules, because the Chauvet cave with which I start gets sealed up and then doesn't get open for about 30,000 years, and it is sort of like a time capsule. Another time capsule is Pompeii. Often these are moments of destruction that paradoxically also preserve a moment of culture. And that was true with the eruption of the volcano in Pompeii in AD 79. One of the things that we know, because of thanks to the volcano, is that there was this Indian statue, or South Asian statue, that was found in Pompeii. And it, you know, you can retrace the story of how it probably got there, and it has a lot to say about trade between the Roman Empire and Asia. But it's also clear that small statue of a female goddess probably was part of a history of misunderstanding. It's very likely that the Roman owner of that statue probably thought she was a version of Venus or the Greek Aphrodite, which is not technically true, but that's just part of that history of interpretation and making something that's foreign or from the past your own, understanding it with your own cultural horizon. And that's most likely what happened to the statue as well. And, you know, there are many other examples of that.
The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed, so you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared. Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents with the code squared. Simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code squared to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV.
You're absolutely right. There's so many examples, fantastic examples of this in the book, in the ways in which, for instance, the bust of Nefertiti that you begin with becomes this provocative thing for Freud and Thomas Mann and so on and so forth, despite the fact that in many ways their historical understanding of these objects would now probably not be understandings that would be particularly respected by modern archaeologists and ancient historians, you know, the revision, and yet how productive it was for them to think through and with these objects was important. I mean, I wonder again how you approach this as a teacher, in a sense that, as you said at the beginning, you know, we are to a certain extent in our role trying to, if not set limits upon interpretation, I suppose ensure that the interpretation is not simply kind of imposed upon the work, that it's sensitive to the historical conditions within which it was created, and yet recognizing the kind of generativity of error. I mean, how do we find a balance between understanding, you know, what the object was originally made for and allowing ourselves the freedom to reinterpret it?
Yeah, that's it's an interesting dilemma. The way I would approach it is to say that I want to, you know, when I teach, but you know, also when I write, I want to put students and readers in a position where they learn things, where they have cultural knowledge about this moment or about a work that seems relevant and important to know. That seems more important than sort of imposing an interpretation. So because teaching students and readers cultural facts, forces, putting things in context, I think puts them in a position where they can come up with an interpretation that is grounded in knowledge rather than, you know, something random. And I would say, in the defense of Freud and Thomas Mann, who then, after the statue gets rediscovered, find themselves super intrigued that there is this moment in Egyptian history that apparently we witness, because of that discovery, sort of the birth of monotheism, or sort of a proto-form of monotheism. And while you're absolutely right, Edward, that, you know, some of the spin that Freud puts on this, you know, where he thinks that Moses was an Egyptian, and perhaps Thomas Mann, you know, is speculative. But I would actually say that these artists, in thinking about this cultural moment and writing either a kind of treatise in the case of Freud, or a very long novel in the case of Thomas Mann, contributed to thinking about this episode in history. And I think there are actually current scholars of Egyptology who are quite cognizant of that reception history, and who use it and who interpret it in sort of similar ways, actually. So yes, these were, you know, not scholars, but their response to this fascinating moment in history, I think, was a serious one, and it's still taken seriously. So I think in the end, I'm not trying to hit readers over the head with interpretations, nor do I do that with students, but I think putting people in a position where they can form their own judgment based on some knowledge, I think that's sort of the goal.
And I think it's, you know, it's interesting how often in the history of culture that what have seemed perhaps at first to be errors of interpretation have later been seen to be kind of intuitions of a deeper structure. I mean, I think the number of times when presumably people were crying cultural barbarianism, saying, you know, this is the wrong way to see this, and when actually, you know, it turned out later that, you know, there's a wider agreement with that. So I'm gonna move the conversation on now a little bit to address the question that I suppose is being used to structure this conversation, this event, and which to a certain extent looms over the book and looms over the question of cultural artifacts more generally nowadays, this question of who owns culture. So there in the background, I mean, I think, you know, there's one way to read this book, which is just as a sort of vast soaring flight over the history of culture. But another way to read it is thinking about these questions of cultural appropriation and cancel culture and so on and so forth that have been such a live part of cultural conversations, you know, recently. So I wonder if you could say a little bit about the threat to the ways in which culture functions, has historically functioned, that are posed by, or the danger that's posed by, some of these current conversations that we're having.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The questions of cultural appropriation and cancel culture and so on and so forth were on my mind as I was writing this book, because this is, you know, if you Google culture these days, most likely some of these terms will pop up. And so I think it shows, among other things, that we are at a moment where we fight a lot about culture. And it's true that sometimes I feel like, oh, I wish we were fighting less. But on the other hand, I think there's something good about it, in that people care. They care about culture. This is why we fight about something, we care. So here too, I think it's, in a way, I didn't just want to come down on some position in these contemporary debates, but to take a step back and to sort of gain an understanding of how culture works, how is it transmitted, how do moments of creativity emerge, what happens at these moments of cultural borrowing, in order to, again, inform a little bit the debate, perhaps in similar terms from what we just talked about, putting readers in a position where they now have a lot of sort of perhaps interestingly selected historical episodes that they can use in order to think themselves about, you know, what are the limits of cultural appropriation, who owns what is legitimate, what is not legitimate. So, in the book, I didn't want to say, okay, this is good, this is bad, this is okay, but I wanted to provide a lot of material with which to think about these issues. And so, but, you know, since you want to push me to take some positions, and that's fair enough, and because I do think that there are some implications, perhaps, and maybe to select one, I think also cultural appropriation is used in so many different contexts. And so I don't really use it in the book because of it, but let's just select one context. And that's the, you know, the whole debate about restitution of objects from museums, from the Elgin marbles to statues from Benin and so on and so forth. And I recognize there in this particular context that, for example, arguments of cultural ownership can be quite powerful to say, yes, Lord Elgin had some kind of contract with that allowed him to take something back to England, but it was a little bit murky. And in any case, this was a treaty between two empires, the British Empire, the Ottoman Empire. But there are questions that can be asked, the same about the Nefertiti statue that we talked about earlier, excavated by a Prussian expedition. They were allowed to take certain objects home. How they ended up with the statue of Nefertiti, there are some questions about that. And then there are more crasser examples, like in the case of Benin, where objects were taken just under so clearly exploitative conditions of extreme violence and disrespect, and ended up in museums in, you know, in London and Berlin and New York and other places. So I am, of course, I mean, I don't approve of such theft, especially these extreme cases. I also understand that to say, you know, this comes from our culture, you took it under dubious circumstances, please return it, can be a powerful argument. But perhaps one way of articulating one place in which I ended up in this whole question of ownership is to say the goal of the restitution debate shouldn't be that everything just goes back from where it came, because I think that would leave everyone culturally impoverished. Because I do believe, and that's sort of one takeaway point from this whole history, is that cultural borrowing is just the single most important driver of cultural development. So, if I were to apply this to the restitution debate, I think I would say something, it may not be very practical, but to say the goal is not just to return everything, but to say, you know, let's return Benin statues as museums have begun to do, but let's send something else with them and let's come to an agreement about how we can maybe borrow some of these statues back and how they can continue to circulate in a better form to the one that under, you know, the conditions under which they were taken, because I do believe that the goal should be more circulation, though perhaps better circulation than less circulation. And I do sometimes worry that getting too stuck on the language of ownership erects barriers that in the end are not helpful to anyone.
Yeah, I agree with you that part of the problem here might be the tendency to fall back on metaphors of ownership, which is a very vague concept which can range, you know, across all sorts of different things. I entirely also agree with you on the need to retain circulation. And in fact, I have also had a pet theory that instead of, you know, sending back Elgin marbles and Benin bronzes, that the government should be forced to give them an equivalent number of Turners and First Folios, you know. And so if there's anyone on here listening who has the power to make that happen, consider that as an option, although it's entirely possible that the Greeks don't want a bunch of Turners. But anyway, yeah, so I think you're right that there is part of the problem here is about the tendency to reach reflexively towards a notion of ownership, which can apply to some things and, you know, doesn't apply very well to others. So again, you know, part of the cultural appropriation debate is perhaps complicated by distinction between objects and ideas. So, you know, thinking as a kind of limit experiment. On the one hand, presumably, you know, you're not telling people to go into the National Gallery and take a Rembrandt off the wall or to go into bookstores and steal your book. So, you know, there is a way of owning a kind of a cultural object. But on the other hand, there's clearly, a reductio ad absurdum on the other side, which, saying because the, you know, Arabs invented love poetry, which transmitted through the troubadours, that no one should be allowed to, you know, they should have a kind of domaine d'origine contrôlée on love poetry, and no one should be able to write it except them. So there's clearly, to a certain extent, absurdities on both ends. So my question is to you about where do we draw the line? Where do we cease to be able to own a cultural object and start to be able to own and start to have something that really can't be laid claim to by any particular group.
Yeah, you know, I think you're so right. Once you move beyond objects, I think it becomes very hard to use the language, and ill-advised to use the language of ownership, I feel. And so I think, actually, the more I think about it, the more I really think that it is impossible to draw the line. Who should draw the line? Who should be allowed? You know, sometimes when it comes to immaterial cultural forms and ideas, the language of cultural appropriation is used, I think, to avoid shallow, or just sort of super superficial uses of objects from another culture or from the past. And yes, that's not great. I'm not for that. But I find myself harder and harder to press to say, you know, this is good informed use and this isn't. I do think it's important to generate a culture in which people want to learn more about something, even if they, you know, find it on YouTube or somewhere, where I think it's okay to say, okay, I don't know very much about this, but it intrigues me, so let's try to find out more about it. And so I'm all for instilling that, but I don't want to be the professor who says, no, you don't know enough about this, or you haven't earned the right to write love poetry in this particular style. I just find it impossible to do. And, you know, and since you mentioned copyright in my own book, I'd say that, you know, the royalties we authors get are so minuscule that people are actually, you know, I don't want to encourage theft, but no one should feel guilty with respect to me if they steal a copy of my book or find it on the internet in some form. And the thing about copyright, you know, it's not a book about copyright, in part because copyright, serious copyright protections have only been around for like 130, 140 years. But the key idea about intellectual copyright is that it has expired and it should be very short, so that there are some incentives for, you know, creative artists and so on and so forth to make a living. And that's, of course, important. But that it expires, because the idea behind it is that you cannot individually control this, you know, for generations, because culture, in the end, we all own culture together. Because it is part of that, you know, I started to think of it almost like a species history of humans, because we keep doing this thing, namely to producing cultural objects. And so I'm quite critical of, you know, especially in the US, copyright protections keep getting increased and increased and increased because of the Disney corporations and the other big corporations. And that's, I think, another way of, you know, coming back to what you said earlier, namely that our cultural moment, in this moment of capitalism, we revert too quickly to ownership. And if you look at the history of copyright protections in the last 50 years, it's all been driven by big Disney corporations. And that alone, I think, should give us pause when we use ownership as a kind of crucial way of thinking about culture.
You know, one of the difficulties here, as you say, in a copyright case, it's important to allow the producer of the art object the ability to earn a living off that. But beyond that, it's quite difficult to say who can lay claim, legitimate claim, to ownership of this object. And similarly, when talking about legitimate interpretations, illegitimate interpretations, who can decide on these legitimate, you know, on what constitutes a legitimate or an illegitimate interpretation? And to a certain extent, one ends up falling back on kind of assertions of authority over an object. And it's not quite clear, you know, on what those things are grounded. But I wonder if, you know, you had any... You know, if there were feelings of exception, you know, even if ownership of culture is not a useful way to think about this, whether this concept of cultural appropriation, you know, we can maybe talk about some of the more, famous stories of this that have come up in the media, whether there are instances of this that you are you're tempted to consider as exceptions to your general way of thinking, or, you know, confirmatory cases.
Yeah. So I think it's an interesting question. So in the end, I mean, there are lots of moments of cultural contact or someone using something that I think are bad or rife with violence and exploitation. So there's no question about that. I can come up with 5 million, and there are many stories like that in the book. You know, when the Spanish conquistadors come to encounter the Aztecs and burn down their cities and destroy their books so that very few survive. I mean, there are a lot of moments of cultural violence that's inflicted here that obviously are terrible. But when it comes especially to the sort of more famous cases that go through media here and that get labeled a cultural appropriation, I think my instinct is to say, let's actually look at how what people who use the language of cultural appropriation are trying to accomplish by using this phrase. And I think in most cases, I find that there are actually better alternatives. I mean, one famous case about, 7 or 8 years ago that went through the media a lot in the US, especially the right-wing media, were these students at Oberlin College, a very liberal arts college, that complained that the cafeteria had sort of started an international corner and was offering sushi and banh mi sandwiches, and then Japanese and Vietnamese students complained that the cafeteria was practicing cultural appropriation. And so, you know, it's very easy to make fun of this, and a lot of people did. And I actually don't want to make fun of it, because if you actually look at the student newspapers, you know, where the students were recorded as saying these things and writing these op-eds, what they actually were trying to say is that this was really terrible sushi. And the banh mi sandwiches, they used the wrong bread, they used ciabatta bread, and it was just really bad food that somehow got put in that international corner of the cafeteria. And so, you know, again, I'm not for bad sushi or these terrible fake banh mi sandwiches that were served, but this is a case where I think the argument to make is not, you know, cultural appropriation, because then you are in a situation where you say, you know, should only Japanese students eat sushi or only Japanese sushi chefs create sushis? But it's sort of an argument about quality and how serious is this engagement with this cultural practice. And where, again, where you want to create a culture of engagement and of knowledge rather than shallow and superficial one. But where, in my case at least, I feel like the much more effective way has to do with quality and to look at, you know, what went wrong here, rather than to use this language of default to this language of ownership that I feel like is actually not very effective to explain what went wrong here. And so I think this would be my strategy, not to say people who cry cultural appropriation are wrong, but that there may be a better way of thinking about these cases. I don't know whether you have some examples that come to your mind.
I think you put it well, and I think, again, I'm slightly conscious of lapsing back on an economic metaphor here, but perhaps one way to think of it is of the tendency of, you know, within capitalist systems of monopolies to grow unless you have mechanisms to ensure against that, and to kind of ensure the recirculation of energy. And if what one is, or the recirculation of capital in that sense, and if what one is looking for is the recirculation, you know, the circulation of culture, the sharing of culture, that to a certain extent, you know, what one perhaps does have to guard against is a situation in which one, a powerful actor with access to, means of distribution far in excess of everyone else's, becomes the person who is telling everyone else what their culture is. So again, you know, one example that I suppose I used to think of about this is, I think there was a furore a few years ago about Beyoncé, and I apologize in advance if there are any, you know, Queen Bey fans out there, but Beyoncé using henna in a music video or something like this. And on the one hand, this seems a little silly. You know, you would try and prevent someone from celebrating, whereas she was, you know, she was not trying to mock or undermine the idea of the use of henna hand decoration, you know, and she was obviously celebrating its cultural power and its beauty. On the other hand, you know, part of my mind goes to the cultural use of henna in say India, where it's a ritual which binds together the community because it's something that, you know, mothers do with their daughters and grandmothers do with their grandchildren. And, you know, the prospect of that child, you know, some child who spends more time with their iPhone than they do with their grandparent, learning about and coming to associate henna decorations with Beyoncé rather than with their grandmother, whilst certainly not something that I'd want to, or I don't think that the, you know, kind of legislative and capitalist language of cultural appropriation necessarily fits, it does nevertheless conjure a sadness in me that would be how they would know about it. So I suppose a question is, especially in this modern global hyper-connected environment, how we prevent the world from being kind of flooded with cheap ersatz versions of, you know, being flooded with bad banh mi and bad bad sushi, rather than having access to good banh mi and you know, good sushi, and making sure that the traditions which lie at the heart of making that, you know, of producing that with kind of love and knowledge aren't stamped out by things that simply have a greater kind of a greater ability to produce quickly and cheaply and circulate more widely.
No, I hear that. I don't think we'll be able to stop the, you know, circulation of lot. I mean, we live in an age of circulation. And I think my instinct always is to say, you know, we can't prevent that anyway. But how can we use it? And who knows what the effects of people learning from Beyoncé about this particular cultural practice ultimately are? You know, since we're now talking about the very end of the book in a sense, and these cases, internet. This is why I end with K-pop, because K-pop sort of came of age, of course, with the internet. And I mentioned this anecdote where, you know, I'm too old to have grown up with K-pop. I think you are too. And so, I don't have kids, but lots of, you know, friends do. And my nephew was, and kids are friends. And so I mentioned this anecdote. I was actually staying with a friend in Norway, and his kid was, I think, 11 at the time. You know, I show up for breakfast, and the kid is already up and has set his alarm. And, you know, 11, 12-year-olds don't want to get up early for school. And he's been up and studying Korean with a textbook by himself because he's been fascinated by Korea because of his K-pop idols. And so, yes, you can, you know, you can say, just watching K-pop videos, what's worth that? But you never know what a first encounter in a, you know, let's shallow or mass media kind of way, what it leads to. And again, this makes me think that we can't adjudicate it that way. What we can do is try to foster, as you put it so nicely, a culture of engagement, of wanting to learn really where does this come from, rather than being content with, you know, just sharing a video. And so I think the strategy here is again, it's not one of cultural ownership, but of cultural engagement, valuing that, instilling that in people. I think that's the way to go.
No, I think you're absolutely right. And I think I'm talking about some limit cases. And in fact, you know, I think, you know, K-pop and BTS, with which my kids are, you know, my youngest son is obsessed, is a very good example of both, you know, to a certain extent, BTS is built on imitations or, you know, reformulations of the young Michael Jackson itself. It sounds very much like that. And on the other hand, you know, the fact that BTS is globally dominant suggests that good cultural productions can win out even over, you know, capital asymmetries or power asymmetries or whatever. So there's so many more things that we could talk about, but we're out of time. So I think I'll draw it to a close there just by thanking you. So my thanks to Martin Puchner and to our audience and to Intelligence Squared.
Thanks for listening to Intelligence Squared. This episode was produced by Hannah Kay. We'd love to hear your feedback and what you think we should talk about next, who we should have on, and what our future debates should be. Send us an email or a voice note with your thoughts to podcasts@intelligencesquared.com. And if you'd like to hear more, attend some of our live events, or peruse over 20 years of our back catalogue featuring some of the world's greatest minds, then head over to intelligencesquared.com.
What are you doing right now? Perhaps you're in the supermarket. Maybe you're on a run or on the commute. But wherever you are in the world, and whatever you're doing, right now you're also listening to my voice. This is the power of podcasts. The ability to communicate with your audience in an intimate and intentional way through audio. I'm Bea Duncan, Senior Partnerships Producer at Intelligence Squared. We've been a world-leading forum for talks, debates, and events for over two decades. And we also use our cutting-edge curation, creativity, and editorial expertise to elevate your brand to new audiences with podcasting. Intrigued? To find out what we can do for your organization, book into a free consultation with me today. Find out more by going to www.intelligencesquared.com/partnerships.